This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time. This is the author, Maria Konnikova. For my parents, Jane and Vitaly, who taught me that life is never fair, nothing comes for free, and there is no such thing as the exception to the rule. How cheerfully he seems to grin, how neatly spreads his claws, and welcomes little fishes in with gently smiling jaws. Lewis Carroll, Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. We aren't robbers, you and I. To rob a fool, you don't need knives. Just flatter him, tell him sweet lies, and he is yours for life. Bulat Akujava, of Gluttons, Braggarts, and Fools, The Con Artist's Duet. Let mortals beware of words, for with words we lie, can say peace when we mean war, foul though speak fair, and promise falsely. W. H. Auden, United Nations Hymn. Introduction. The Aristocrats of Crime, David Moore. Dr. Joseph Sear, a surgeon lieutenant of the Royal Canadian Navy, walked onto the deck of the HMCS Cayuga. It was September 1951, the second year of the Korean War, and the Cayuga was making her way north of the 38th parallel, just off the shore of North Korea. The morning had gone smoothly enough. No sickness, no injuries to report. But just as the afternoon was getting on, the lookouts spotted something that didn't quite fit with the watery landscape. A small, cramped Korean junk that was waving a flag and frantically making its way toward the ship. Within the hour, the rickety boat had pulled up alongside the Cayuga. Inside was a mess of bodies, 19 in all, piled together in obvious filth. They looked close to death. Mangled torsos, bloody, bleeding heads, limbs that turned the wrong way or failed to turn at all. Most of them were no more than boys. They had been caught in an ambush, a Korean liaison officer soon explained to the Cayuga's crew. The messy bullet and shrapnel wounds were the result. That's why Dr. Sear had been summoned from below deck. He was the only man with any medical qualification on board. He would have to operate, and soon. Without his intervention, all 19 men would very likely die. Dr. Sear began to prepare his kit. There was only one problem. Dr. Sear didn't hold a medical degree, let alone the proper qualifications required to undertake complex surgery aboard a moving ship. In fact, he'd never even graduated high school. And his real name wasn't Sear. It was Ferdinand Waldo Damara, or, as he would eventually become known, the Great Imposter, one of the most successful confidence artists of all time, memorialized, in part, in Robert Crichton's 1959 account, The Great Imposter. His career would span decades, his disguises, the full gamut of professional life. But nowhere was he more at home than in the guise of the master of human life, the doctor. Over the next 48 hours, Damara would somehow fake his way through the surgeries, with the help of a medical textbook, a field guide he had persuaded a fellow physician back in Ontario to create for the troops in the event a doctor wasn't readily available, copious antibiotics for the patients, and alcohol for himself, and a healthy dose of supreme confidence in his own abilities. After all, he'd been a doctor before, not to mention a psychologist, and a professor, and a monk, many monks in fact, and the founder of a religious college. Why couldn't he be a surgeon? As Damara performed his medical miracles on the high seas, makeshift operating table tied down to protect the patients from the roll of the waves, a zealous young press officer wandered the decks in search of a story. The Home Office was getting on his back. They needed good copy. He needed good copy. Little of note had been happening for weeks. He was, he joked to his shipmates, practically starving for news. When word of the Korean rescue spread among the crew, it was all he could do to hide his excitement. Dr. Sear's story was fantastic. It was, indeed, perfect. Sear hadn't been required to help the enemy, but his honorable nature had compelled him to do so. And with what results? 19 surgeries, and 19 men departing the Cayuga in far better shape than they'd arrived. Would the good doctor agree to a profile to commemorate the momentous events of the week? Who was Damara to resist? He had grown so sure of his invulnerability, so confident in the borrowed skin of Joseph Sear, M.D., that no amount of media attention was too much. And he had performed some pretty masterful operations, if he might say so himself. Dispatches about the great feats of Dr. Sear soon spread throughout Canada. Dr. Joseph Sear, original version, felt his patience running out. It was October 23rd, and there he was, sitting quietly in Edmundston, trying his damnedest to read a book in peace. But they simply wouldn't leave him alone. The phone was going crazy, ringing the second he replaced the receiver. Was he the doctor in Korea, the well-intentioned callers wanted to know? Was it his son, another relative? No, he told anyone who bothered to listen. No relation. There were many Sears out there, and many Joseph Sears. It was not he. A few hours later, Sear received another call, this time from a good friend who now read aloud the miracle doctor's credentials. There may be many Joseph Sears, but this particular one boasted a background identical to his own. At some point, coincidence just didn't cut it. Sear asked his friend for a photograph. Surely there was some mistake. He knew precisely who this was. Wait, this is my friend, Brother John Payne of the Brothers of Christian Instruction, he said, the surprise evident in his voice. Brother Payne had been a novice when Sear knew him. He'd taken the name after shedding his secular life. And that life, Sear well recalled, was a medical one much like his own. Dr. Cecil B. Hamon, he believed, the man's original name was. But why, even if he had returned once more to medicine, would he ever use Sear's name instead? Surely his own medical credentials were enough. Damara's deception rapidly began to unravel. And unravel it did, but his eventual dismissal from the Navy was far from signaling the end of his career. Profoundly embarrassed, the future of the nation's defense was on its shoulders, and it couldn't even manage the security of its own personnel. The Navy did not press charges. Damara, alias Sear, was quietly dismissed and asked to leave the country. He was only too happy to oblige, and despite his newfound and short-lived notoriety, he would go on to successfully impersonate an entire panoply of humanity, from prison warden to instructor at a school for mentally retarded children, to humble English teacher, to civil engineer who was almost awarded a contract to build a large bridge in Mexico. By the time he died, over 30 years later, Dr. Sear would be but one of the dozens of aliases that peppered Damara's history. Among them, that of his own biographer, Robert Crichton, an alias he assumed soon after the book's publication, and long before the end of his career as an imposter. Time and time again, Damara, Fred to those who knew him undisguised, found himself in positions of the highest authority, in charge of human minds in the classroom, bodies in the prison system, lives on the decks of the Cayuga. Time and time again, he would be exposed, only to go back and succeed yet again at inveigling those around him. How was he so effective? Was it that he preyed on particularly soft, credulous targets? I'm not sure the Texas prison system, one of the toughest in the United States, could be described as such. Was it that he presented an especially compelling, trustworthy figure? Not likely at 6'1" and over 250 pounds, square linebacker's jaw framed by small eyes that seemed to sit on the border between amusement and chicanery, an expression that made Crichton's 4-year-old daughter Sarah cry and shrink in fear the first time she ever saw it. Or was it something else? Something deeper and more fundamental? Something that says more about ourselves and how we see the world? It's the oldest story ever told. The story of belief, of the basic, irresistible, universal human need to believe in something that gives life meaning, something that reaffirms our view of ourselves, the world, and our place in it. Religion, Voltaire is said to have remarked, began when the first scoundrel met the first fool. It certainly sounds like something he would have said. Voltaire was no fan of the religious establishment. but versions of the exact same words have been attributed to Mark Twain, to Carl Sagan, to Geoffrey Chaucer. It seems so accurate that someone, somewhere, sometime must certainly have said it. And it seems so accurate, most of all, because it touches on a profound truth. The truth of our absolute and total need for belief, from our earliest moments of consciousness, from an infant's unwavering knowledge that she will be fed and comforted, to an adult's need to see some sort of justice and fairness in the surrounding world. In some ways, confidence artists like Damara have it easy. We've done most of the work for them. We want to believe in what they're telling us. Their genius lies in figuring out what precisely it is we want and how they can present themselves as the perfect vehicle for delivering on that desire. The imposters, like Damara, showing up where they are needed, in the guise they are most needed, a qualified doctor volunteering for the Navy when there is a severe shortage of physicians, a prison warden eager to take on the most difficult inmates where no one wants to step in, the Ponzi schemer who arrives with the perfect investment at a time when money is short and the market's shaky, the academic who creates just the cloning breakthrough everyone has been awaiting, the art dealer with the perfect Rothko that the collector simply hasn't been able to locate anywhere else, the politician with the long-awaited solution to a thorny issue that's been plaguing the town for years, the healer with just the right remedy, just the right tincture, just the right touch, the journalist with the perfect story to illustrate an important point, and, long before any of these are born, the religious leader who promises hope and salvation when everything seems to have hit a low point, who swears that, somewhere, sometime, the world will be just. In the 1950s, the linguist David Moore began to delve more deeply into the world of confidence men than any had before him. He called them, simply, aristocrats of crime. Hard crime, outright theft or burglary, violence, threats, is not what the confidence artist is about. The confidence game, the con, is an exercise in soft skills. Trust, sympathy, persuasion. The true con artist doesn't force us to do anything. He makes us complicit in our own undoing. He doesn't steal. We give. He doesn't have to threaten us. We supply the story ourselves. We believe because we want to, not because anyone made us. And so, we offer up whatever they want. Money, reputation, trust, fame, legitimacy, support, and we don't realize what is happening until it is too late. Our need to believe, to embrace things that explain our world, is as pervasive as it is strong. Given the right cues, we're willing to go along with just about anything and put our confidence in just about anyone. Conspiracy theories, supernatural phenomena, psychics, we have a seemingly bottomless capacity for credulity. Or, as one psychologist put it, gullibility may be deeply ingrained in the human behavioral repertoire. For our minds are built for stories. We crave them, and when there aren't ready ones available, we create them. Stories about our origins, our purpose, the reasons the world is the way it is. Human beings don't like to exist in a state of uncertainty or ambiguity. When something doesn't make sense, we want to supply the missing link. When we don't understand what or why or how something happened, we want to find the explanation. A confidence artist is only too happy to comply, and the well-crafted narrative is his absolute forte. There's a likely apocryphal story about the French poet Jacques Prévert. One day he was walking past a blind man who held up a sign, "Blind man without a pension." He stopped to chat. "How is it going? Were people helpful?" "Not great," the man replied. "Some people give, but not a lot, and most just keep walking." "Could I borrow your sign?" Prévert asked. The blind man nodded. The poet took the sign, flipped it over, and wrote a message. The next day, he again walked past the blind man. "How is it going now?" he asked. "Incredible," the man replied. "I've never received so much money in my life." On the sign, Prévert had written, "Spring is coming, but I won't see it." Give us a compelling story and we open up. Skepticism gives way to belief. The same approach that makes a blind man's cup overflow with donations can make us more receptive to most any persuasive message, for good or for ill. When we step into a magic show, we come in actively wanting to be fooled. We want deception to cover our eyes and make our world a tiny bit more fantastical, more awesome than it was before. And the magician, in many ways, uses the exact same approaches as a confidence man, only without the destruction of the con's endgame. Magic is a kind of a conscious, willing con, Michael Shermer, a science historian and writer who has devoted many decades to debunking claims about the supernatural and the pseudoscientific, told me one December afternoon. You're not being foolish to fall for it. If you don't fall for it, the magician is doing something wrong. Shermer, the founder of the Skeptic Society and Skeptic Magazine, has thought extensively about how the desire to embrace magic so often translates into susceptibility to its less savory forms. Take the Penn and Teller cups and balls routine. They use clear plastic cups so you can see exactly what's happening, but it still works. At their root, magic tricks and confidence games share the same fundamental principle, a manipulation of our beliefs. Magic operates at the most basic level of visual perception, manipulating how we see and experience reality. It changes for an instant what we think possible, quite literally taking advantage of our eyes and brain's foibles to create an alternative version of the world. The con does the same thing, but can go much deeper. Quick tricks like three-card Monty are identical to a magician's routine, except the intent is more nefarious. But long cons, the kind that take weeks, months, or even years to unfold, manipulate reality at a higher level, playing with our most basic beliefs about humanity and the world. The real confidence game feeds on the desire for magic, exploiting our endless taste for an existence that is more extraordinary and somehow more meaningful. But when we're falling for a con, we aren't actively seeking deception, or at least we don't think we are. As long as the desire for magic, for a reality that is somehow greater than our everyday existence, remains, the confidence game will thrive. The confidence game has existed long before the term itself was first used, likely in 1849, during the trial of William Thompson. The elegant Thompson, according to the New York Herald, would approach passers-by on the streets of Manhattan, start up a conversation, and then come forward with a unique request. "Have you confidence in me to trust me with your watch until tomorrow?" Faced with such a quixotic question, and one that hinged directly on respectability, many a stranger proceeded to part with his timepiece. And so, the confidence man was born, the person who uses others' trust in him for his own private purposes. "Have you confidence in me? What will you give me to prove it?" Cons come in all guises. Short cons, like the infamous three-card Monty or shell game, feats of sleight of hand and theatrics still played avidly on the streets of Manhattan. Long cons that take time and ingenuity to build up, from imposter schemes to Ponzi's to the building of outright new realities, a new country, a new technology, a new cure, that have found a comfortable home in the world of the internet, and remain as well safely ensconced in their old offline guises. Many come with fanciful names. Pig in a Poke, dating back at least to 1530, when Richard Hill's commonplace book suggested that when ye proffer the pig, open the poke, lest what comes out of the bag is not a pig at all. The Spanish Prisoner, called by the New York Times in 1898, one of the oldest and most attractive and probably most successful swindles known to the police, dates back at least to the 1500s. The Magic Wallet, the Gold Brick, the Green Goods, Banco, the Big Store, the Wire, the Payoff, the Rag. The names are as colorful as they are plentiful. The con is the oldest game there is, but it's also one that is remarkably well-suited to the modern age. If anything, the whirlwind advance of technology heralds a new golden age of the grift. Cons thrive in times of transition and fast change, when new things are happening and old ways of looking at the world no longer suffice. That's why they flourished during the gold rush and spread with manic fury in the days of westward expansion. That's why they thrive during revolutions, wars, and political upheavals. Transition is the confidence game's great ally, because transition breeds uncertainty. There's nothing a con artist likes better than exploiting the sense of unease we feel when it appears that the world as we know it is about to change. We may cling cautiously to the past, but we also find ourselves open to things that are new and not quite expected. Who's to say this new way of doing business isn't the wave of the future? In the 19th century, we had the Industrial Revolution, and many present-day scam techniques developed in its wake. Today, we have the Technological Revolution, and this one, in some ways, is best suited to the con of all. With the internet, everything is shifting at once, from the most basic things, how we meet people and make meaningful connections, to the diurnal rhythms of our lives, how we shop, how we eat, how we schedule meetings, make dates, plan vacations. Shy away from everything. You're a technophobe or worse. You met how? Online? And you're getting married? Embrace it too openly, though, and the risks that used to come your way only in certain circumscribed situations, a walk down Canal Street past a three-card Monte table, an investment opportunity from the man in your club, and so forth, are a constant presence anytime you open your iPad. That's why no amount of technological sophistication or growing scientific knowledge or other markers we like to point to as signs of societal progress will or can make cons any less likely. The same schemes that were playing out in the big stores of the Wild West are now being run via your inbox. The same demands that were being made over the wire are hitting your cell phone. A text from a family member, a frantic call from the hospital, a Facebook message from a cousin who seems to have been stranded in a foreign country. When Catch Me If You Can hero Frank Abagnale, who as a teen conned his way through most any organization you can imagine, from airlines to hospitals, was recently asked if his escapades could happen in the modern world, a world of technology and seemingly ever-growing sophistication, he laughed. "Far, far simpler now," he said. "What I did 50 years ago as a teenage boy is 4,000 times easier to do today because of technology. Technology breeds crime. It always has and always will." Technology doesn't make us more worldly or knowledgeable. It doesn't protect us. It's just a change of venue for the same old principles of confidence. What are you confident in? The con artist will find those things where your belief is unshakable, and will build on that foundation to subtly change the world around you. But you will be so confident in the starting point that you won't even notice what's happened. Since 2008, consumer fraud in the United States has gone up by more than 60%. Online scams have more than doubled. Back in 2007, they made up 1/5 of all fraud cases. In 2011, they were 40%. In 2012 alone, the Internet Crime Complaint Center reported almost 300,000 complaints of online fraud. The total lost? $525 million. For the total U.S. population between 2011 and 2012, the last period surveyed by the Federal Trade Commission, a little over 10% of adults, or 25.6 million, had fallen victim to fraud. The total number of fraudulent incidents was even higher, topping 37.8 million. The majority of the cases, affecting just over 5 million adults, involved one scheme, fake weight loss products. In second place, at 2.4 million adults, prize promotions. Coming in third at 1.9 million, buyers clubs, those annoying offers you usually toss out with the recycling, where what seems like a free deal suddenly translates to endless unwanted and far from free charges for memberships you didn't even know you signed up for. Followed by unauthorized internet billing, 1.9 million, and work-at-home programs, 1.8 million. About a third of the incidents were initiated online. Last year in the UK, An estimated 58% of households received fraudulent calls, seemingly from banks, police, computer companies, or other credible-sounding businesses. Some call recipients were wise to the scam, but somehow, close to £24 million was lost to the scammers, up from £7 million the year prior. Countless more cases go unreported. Most cases, in fact, by some estimates. According to a recent study from the AARP, only 37% of victims older than 55 will admit to having fallen for a con. Just over half of those under 55 do so. No one wants to admit to having been duped. Most con artists don't ever come to trial. They simply aren't brought to the authorities to begin with. No matter the medium or the guise, cons, at their core, are united by the same basic principles. Principles that rest on the manipulation of belief. Cons go unreported, indeed undetected, because none of us want to admit that our basic beliefs could be wrong. It matters little if we're dealing with a Ponzi scheme or falsified data, fake quotes or misleading information, fraudulent art or doubtful health claims, a false version of history, or a less than honest version of the future. At a fundamental, psychological level, it's all about confidence, or rather, the taking advantage of somebody else's. This book is not a history of the con, nor is it an exhaustive look at every con there ever was. It is, rather, an exploration of the psychological principles that underlie each and every game, from the most elementary to the most involved, step by step, from the moment the endeavor is conceived to the aftermath of its execution. The confidence game starts with basic human psychology. From the artist's perspective, it's a question of identifying the victim, the put-up. Who is he? What does he want? And how can I play on that desire to achieve what I want? It requires the creation of empathy and rapport, the play. An emotional foundation must be laid before any scheme is proposed, any game set in motion. Only then does it move to logic and persuasion, the rope, the scheme, the tale, the evidence and the way it will work to your benefit, the convincer, the show of actual profits. And like a fly caught in a spider's web, the more we struggle, the less able to extricate ourselves we become, the breakdown. By the time things begin to look dicey, we tend to be so invested, emotionally and often physically, that we do most of the persuasion ourselves. We may even choose to up our involvement ourselves, even as things turn south, the send, so that by the time we're completely fleeced, the touch, we don't quite know what hit us. The con artist may not even need to convince us to stay quiet, the blow off and fix. We are more likely than not to do so ourselves. We are, after all, the best deceivers of our own minds. At each step of the game, con artists draw from a seemingly endless toolbox of ways to manipulate our belief. And as we become more committed, with every step we give them more psychological material to work with. Everyone has heard the saying, if it seems too good to be true, it probably is. Or it's close relative, there's no such thing as a free lunch. But when it comes to ourselves, we tend to latch on to that probably. If it seems too good to be true, it is. Unless it's happening to me. We deserve our good fortune. I deserve that big art break. I've worked in galleries all my life and I had this coming. I deserve true love. I've been in bad relationships long enough. I deserve good returns on my money at long last. I've gotten quite the experience over the years. The mentalities of too good to be true and I deserve are unfortunately at odds. But we remain blind to the tension when it comes to our own actions and decisions. When we see other people talking about their unbelievable deal or crazy good fortune, we realize at once that they've been taken for a sucker. But when it happens to us, well, I am just lucky and deserving of a good turn. We get, too, a unique satisfaction from thinking ourselves invulnerable. Who doesn't enjoy the illicit glimpse into the life of the underworld? And the satisfaction of knowing that clever old you would be smarter than all that, that you can laugh at that poor sap who fell for something so obvious and still be safe in the knowledge that you are keener, savvier, more cynical and skeptical. They may fall for it. You?
Never.
And yet, when it comes to the con, everyone is a potential victim. Despite our deep certainty in our own immunity, or rather, because of it, we all fall for it. That's the genius of the great confidence artists. They are truly artists, able to affect even the most discerning connoisseurs with their persuasive charm. A theoretical particle physicist or the CEO of a major Hollywood studio is no more exempt than an 80-year-old Florida retiree who guilelessly signs away his retirement savings for a not-to-miss investment that never materializes. A savvy Wall Street investor is just as likely to fall for a con as a market neophyte. A prosecutor who questions motives for a living as likely to succumb as your gullible next-door neighbor who thinks The Onion prints real news. So how do they do it? What makes us believe? And how do people take advantage of that process for their own ends? At some point, everyone will be deceived. Everyone will fall victim to a confidence artist of one stripe or another. Everyone will fall for it. The real question is why? And can you ever understand your own mind well enough that you learn to extricate yourself before it's too late? Chapter 1, The Grifter and the Mark. He does not answer questions or gives evasive answers. He speaks nonsense, rubs the great toe along the ground, and shivers. His face is discolored. He rubs the roots of his hair with his fingers. Profile of a Liar, 900 BCE. Whenever people ask me if I've ever been conned, I tell them the truth. I have no idea. I've never given money to a Ponzi scheme or gotten tripped up on an unwinnable game of three-card Monty. That much I know. And there have been some smaller deceptions I've certainly fallen for, though whether they qualify as full-fledged cons is a matter of dispute. But here's the thing about cons. The best of them are never discovered. We don't ever realize we've fallen. We simply write our loss off as a matter of bad luck. Magicians often resist showing the same trick twice. Once the element of surprise is gone, the audience becomes free to pay attention to everything else, and is thus much more likely to discern the ruse. But the best tricks can be repeated ad infinitum. They are so well honed that there is practically no deception to spot. Harry Houdini, the magician and famed exposer of frauds, boasted that he could figure out any trick once he'd thrice seen it. One evening at Chicago's Great Northern Hotel, the story goes, a fellow conjurer, Di Vernon, approached him with a card trick. Vernon removed a card from the top of the deck and asked Houdini to initial it, an HH in the corner. The card was then placed in the middle of the deck. Vernon snapped his fingers. It was a miracle. The top card in the deck was now Houdini's. It was, as the name of the routine suggests, an ambitious card. No matter where you put it, it rose to the top. 7 times Vernon demonstrated, and 7 times Houdini was stumped. The truly clever trick needs no hiding. In this case, it was a sleight-of-hand effect that is often performed by skilled magicians today, but was, back then, a novelty. When it comes to cons, the exact same principle holds. The best confidence games remain below the radar. They are never prosecuted because they are never detected. Or, as in Damara's case, they are detected, but the embarrassment is too great. I wouldn't be surprised if Houdini had kept quiet about his inability to spot Vernon's trick had the two men met in a less public setting. It's not uncommon, in fact, for the same person to fall for the exact same con multiple times. James Franklin Norfleet, a Texas rancher you'll meet again later on, lost first $20,000 and then, in short order, $25,000 to the exact same racket and the exact same gang. He'd never realized the first go-around was a scam. David Moore describes one victim who, several years after falling for a well-known wire con, the grifter pretends to have a way of getting race results seconds before they are announced, allowing the mark to place a sure win bet, spotted his deceivers on the street. He ran towards them. Their hearts sank. Surely he was going to turn them in. Not at all. He was wondering if he could once more play that game he'd lost at way back when. He was certain that, this time, his luck had turned. The men were only too happy to comply. Even someone like Bernie Madoff went undetected for at least 20 years. He was 70 when his scheme crumbled. What if he died before it blew up? One can imagine a future where his victims would be none the wiser, as long as new investments kept coming in. In June 2007, Slate writer Justin Peters decided to be creative about his airfare to Italy. Short on money, he was nevertheless eager to spend a few months out of the country. And he had what he considered a pretty damn brilliant plan for solving the dilemma. He'd buy airline miles from someone willing to part with them, and then use them to purchase a reduced fare. He promptly started scouring the internet for anyone with a mile surplus. He was lucky. Soon after he began his search, he found Captain Chris Hansen, a pilot with countless unused miles he'd put up for purchase on Craigslist. Peters quickly replied to his posting. God forbid the miles went to someone else. They talked on the phone. Captain Chris seemed knowledgeable and friendly. Our conversation convinced me that he was on the level, Peters writes. A deal was promptly arranged. $650, 100,000 miles, PayPal. Simple. Except PayPal rejected the transaction. How odd, Peters thought. He followed up with the captain about the error. The pilot was strangely silent. Peters, however, was desperate. His scheduled departure date loomed ever closer, and still no tickets. So he returned to the hunt. Bingo. Franco Borga, ready seller of miles. Borga responded promptly and, of all things, included his driver's license in the reply. He was who he said he was, not some Craigslist scammer. A phone call later, a very nice conversation, and they were in business. $700 on a Green Dot card, and the miles would be his. Green Dot cards, a favorite of the con artist, are gift cards that you can easily buy at any supermarket or drugstore. You can recharge them, and anyone with the account number can access the balance, a way to move funds without the hassle of a wire transfer. 4 days later, still no miles. It was finally dawning on Peters that he might have been scammed. But then, lo and behold, his long-lost pilot resurfaced. He'd been abroad, he explained, with limited email access, but he still had the miles for Peters' use. Victory. Of course Peters still wanted them, especially, he told the captain, after he'd been so callously scammed. Captain Chris sympathized completely. The internet was a predatory place. To put Peters' mind at ease, the captain then sent him a contract. He was, as Peters had always known, on the level. PayPal still on the fritz. Peters quickly wired the promised $650. By this point, everyone but Peters can see how the story will end. 3 days, no miles. 4, 5, 6 days, no miles, no emails. He had fallen for the exact same scam twice in 1 week. In this case, he had clear proof of the deception. No miles. But imagine a situation where chance plays a bigger role. A stock market, a race, an investment. Who's to say it wasn't just bad luck? P.T. Barnum may never have said there's a sucker born every minute. He very likely did not. But among the con men of the early 20th century, there was another saying. There's a sucker born every minute, and one to trim 'em and one to knock 'em. There's always something to fall for, and always someone to do the falling. Who is the victim, and who the con man? What kinds of people are the Bernie Madoffs and Captain Hansons of the world? And do a Norfleet and a Peters share some underlying traits that bind them together? Is there a quintessential grifter and a quintessential mark? 18 State Street. A small, two-window-wide cream house. Teal and white trimmed shutters. Grass sprouting in between slabs of surrounding concrete. A small teal and cream garage. A basketball hoop affixed to the top. This is where the great imposter once made his home. although he would do his best to have you forget it. Ferdinand Waldo Damara Jr., our old Korean naval surgeon friend Dr. Sear, was born on December 12, 1921 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, the first son and second child of a prosperous local family. His mother, Mary McNally, was an Irish girl from Salem, Massachusetts, a product of the strictest of Catholic upbringings. His father, Ferdinand Sr., was French-Canadian, the first generation to have made it south of the border. He'd come in search of wealth, and, by the time young Fred was born, had found some semblance of it from the movie business. He'd started as a simple projectionist in Providence, Rhode Island, but over the years he'd saved enough that he dreamed of owning his own theater. In Lawrence, he'd met a local backer, and before long the Toomey Damara Amusement Company was running its first cinema, The Palace. It was a success, and Fred Sr. seemed born to it. He was, Damara's mother later recalled, one of the few men who could carry a cane and sport spats and not look foolish doing it. Fred wasn't born in that modest State Street house. No, sir. He was a product of the fashionable Jackson Street, where his classmates at the Emily G. Weatherby School were mostly the sons of mill workers. He stood out. He was a class above. And a head above, too. Even then, Fred was a giant. Fred wasn't particularly popular, what with his constant better-than-thou-ness. But nor was he particularly disliked. That is, until another boy thought that he'd ratted him out to the teacher. "We're going to get you at lunch," he and a newly formed posse promised. Fred promptly went home at recess, but before lunch he returned. When the boys surrounded him, he pulled out a dueling pistol. "I'm going to shoot your guts out," he threatened. Two more guns were found in his bag, and Fred was suspended. His behavior soon grew so out of control that he was placed in a Catholic school, St. Augustine's, and it was there that he swapped flat-out violence for a slyer sort of approach. St. Augustine's had a Valentine's Day tradition. Each eighth grader would give a seventh grade boy a small gift. It was a simple ceremonial exchange to symbolize a turning over of the class to the rising eighth graders. By the time Fred was in eighth grade, though, the family fortunes had taken a sharp downward turn. Shortly after his 11th birthday, the Toomey Damara Amusement Company went bankrupt. Goodbye, Jackson Street. In its stead, an old carriage house on the outskirts of town, State Street. Damara desperately didn't want to be poor. "Please, little Jesus and Mother Mary," he would pray, "please don't make us poor. If you don't, I'll say a rosary every evening of my life." His prayer went unanswered. That February morning, he wanted to be sure to make an impression, show those poor Catholic kids how a real gentleman behaves. And so he made his way to the bakery and candy shop off Jackson Street, close to the house that was no longer theirs. The family, he knew, still had an account there. He arranged for the largest heart-shaped box of chocolates to be delivered to the school at 3 sharp. The box never came. Somehow the order had gotten lost in the mix, or perhaps the confectioner had grown suspicious that the Damara's account wasn't what it once was. Whatever the holdup, if there was one thing Fred hated more than being poor, it was the humiliation of being called a liar. He'd promised the biggest gift the school had ever seen, and he had come up empty-handed. He vowed to make it right. He returned to the store in a huff. This time, he ordered not only the large heart, but smaller boxes for every child in the grade, to put on his account. This time, there was no mix-up. If the boy had the nerve to order up such a storm, clearly the family could pay. You wouldn't do something like that, and do it so confidently, unless you could back it up. The boxes promptly arrived, wheeled to St. Augustine's in a large cart overflowing with chocolate. The Damara family, of course, had no way of paying for them. From then on, until at 15 he dropped out to join the first of a string of religious orders, Fred Damara was known as the Candy Butcher. And from there, it was a stone's throw to his first full-on con, stealing an unsuspecting student's credentials to try to get a commission in the Navy. Was the life of an imposter always his destiny? Was he born to be a grifter? Con artists are evil human beings with malicious intentions and no conscience. Would that it were so. It would make the world a much easier place to be in. We'd ferret out the bad guys and be on our merry way. The reality, however, is far messier. In his essay, Diddling, Edgar Allan Poe describes the features of the swindler. Minuteness, interest, perseverance, ingenuity, audacity, nonchalance, originality, impertinence, and grin. Modern psychology agrees with him on one particular point, the nonchalance. For the most part, humans have evolved as cooperative animals. We can trust one another, rely on one another, walk around with a wallet full of cash not worrying that every single stranger will rob us, and go to bed with the certainty that we won't be killed in our sleep. Over time, our emotions have evolved to support that status quo. We feel warm and fuzzy when we've helped someone. We feel shame and guilt when we've lied or cheated or otherwise harmed someone. Sure, all of us deviate now and then, but for the most part we've grown to be quite decent, or the opposite of nonchalant. For the most part, we care about others and know that they care to some extent about us. Otherwise, much of society would collapse. But there is an exception. A very small number of people may have evolved to take advantage of the general good of others, fueled by the nonchalance that makes many a con artist what he is. These people don't care. They remain perfectly indifferent to the pain they cause, as long as they end up on top. It makes perfect sense. If the vast majority of the people who surround you are basically decent, you can lie, cheat, and steal all you want and get on famously. But the approach only works if few take advantage of it. If everyone did the same, the system would self-destruct, and we would all end up doing worse. Calculated nonchalance is only an adaptive strategy when it's a minority one. Or, as Adrian Rain, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania whose research centers on antisocial behavior, puts it, persistent immoral behavior can be thought of as an alternative evolutionary strategy that can be beneficial at low rates in society. By lacking the emotional experiences that serve to deter immoral behavior, and by using deception and manipulation, individuals may be able to successfully cheat their way through life. There's another word for this calculated, inbred even, nonchalance. Psychopathy, or the basic absence of empathetic feelings for your fellow human beings. It's nonchalance brought to a biological extreme. But do con artists actually fit that bill? Is it fair to say that the Damaro-like grifters of the world are more likely than not clinical psychopaths? Or are they just slightly more devious versions of our more conniving selves? Is it a qualitative difference between our small daily deceptions and the wiles of the confidence man? Or is it just a simple matter of degree? Robert Hare's psychopathy checklist revised, the most common assessment tool for antisocial, psychopathic behavior, looks for things like responsibility, remorse, pathological lying, manipulativeness, cunning, promiscuity, and general impulsiveness, superficial charm, grandiosity, and the like. Score high enough and you are labeled psychopathic, or suffering soul for the many such you leave in your wake. One of the defining marks of the psychopath is the inability to process emotion like other people. To a true psychopath, your suffering means nothing. There's no empathy, there's no remorse, there's no guilt. When psychopaths experience something that would shock most people, disturbing images, for instance, their pulse stays steady, their sweat glands normal, their heart rates low. In one study of clinical psychopathy, psychopaths failed to engage the same emotional areas as non-psychopaths when making difficult moral decisions. For instance, whether or not to smother a crying baby if doing so would save the entire village, while a failure to do so would condemn everyone, baby included. For the overwhelming majority of people, it's a draining choice. The emotional areas of the brain fight it out with the more utilitarian ones for an answer. In psychopaths, the battle is absent. They exhibit nonchalance in its most extreme form. Psychopaths, according to Hare, make up an estimated 1% of the male population. Among women, they are almost non-existent, though still present. That means that out of every 100 men you meet, one will be clinically diagnosable as a psychopath. But will he also be a born con man? On one level, the data seem to suggest a direct affinity between the two, grifter and psychopath developing hand in hand. One tantalizing piece of evidence? When people acquire the neural deficits associated with psychopathy later in life, they start behaving remarkably, well, psychopathically, and remarkably like a con artist. In lesion studies, people who experienced early life lesions in the polar and ventromedial cortex, areas implicated in psychopathy, begin to show behaviors and personality changes that very closely mimic both psychopathy and the grift. Two such patients, for instance, showed a newfound tendency to lie, manipulate, and break the rules. Others described them as lacking empathy, guilt, remorse, and fear, and unconcerned with their behavioral transgressions. Psychopathy, then, is a sort of biological predisposition that leads to many of the behaviors we expect from the confidence artist. But that's not exactly the whole story. Psychopathy is part of the so-called dark triad of traits. And as it turns out, the other two, narcissism and Machiavellianism, also seem to describe many of the traits we associate with the grifter. Narcissism entails a sense of grandiosity, entitlement, self-enhancement, an overly inflated sense of worth, and manipulativeness. It sounds, in short, like someone much akin to our friend Damara, someone who can't stand to be seen as inferior, who needs to be the center of attention, and who will do what it takes to get there. A narcissist will do what it takes to preserve his image. It's Fred lying to the candy store to avoid embarrassment. Not the greatest of cons, but one driven by that kind of self-centric tendency. But perhaps even more relevant is Machiavellianism, a characteristic that is almost predicated on the ability to deceive, as ruthlessly and effectively as Machiavelli's most ideal of princes and the most famed of confidence artists both. In the psychology literature, Machiavellian has come to mean a specific set of traits that allows one to manipulate others to accomplish one's own objectives, almost a textbook definition of the con. Writing in 1969, Richard Calhoun, a marketing professor at the University of North Carolina, described the Machiavellian as someone who employs aggressive, manipulative, exploiting, and devious moves in order to achieve personal and organizational objectives. And, indeed, the so-called high max, people high on the Machiavellianism scale, a measure first developed in 1970 by two psychologists who wanted to capture leaders' manipulative tendencies, Richard Christie and Florence Geis, tend to be among the most successful manipulators in society. In one series of studies, when a high max was placed in a situation with a low max, he tended to emerge ahead in most any scenario. The low max would let emotions get in the way. The high max, however, wouldn't be as easily disturbed. In one early review, the Machiavellians among 11 distinct samples, including students, academic faculty, parents, children, athletes, the staff of a mental hospital, and business employees, were more likely to attempt to bluff, cheat, bargain, and ingratiate themselves with others. They were also more successful at doing so. In another study, the Machiavellian-minded among us made for more convincing liars than the rest. When people were taped while denying that they had stolen something, half were being honest and half lying, those scoring higher on the Machiavellianism scale were believed significantly more than anyone else. In a third, business school students had to decide whether or not to pay someone a kickback, a behavior that is largely considered unethical and is against the law. They were all given a rationale for why, in this case, the kickback made sense. Those who scored higher in Machiavellianism were more likely to take the bait when the rationale made it more cost-effective to do so. Machiavellianism, it seems, then, may, like psychopathy, predispose people toward con-like behaviors and make them better able to deliver on them. Delroy Paulus, a psychologist at the University of British Columbia who specializes in the dark triad traits, goes as far as to suggest that Machiavellian is a better descriptor of the con artist than psychopath. It seems clear that malevolent stockbrokers such as Bernie Madoff do not qualify as psychopaths, he writes. They are corporate Machiavellians who use deliberate, strategic procedures for exploiting others. So wherein lies the truth? Is the con artist psychopath, narcissist, Machiavellian? A little bit of all? Damara seems to be proof of the all-of-the-above choice. Doctors are often accused of playing God. Damara took that criticism to a grotesque extreme. What ego, what blithe disregard for the lives of others and overconfidence in oneself can lead someone to not only pose as a surgeon, but perform multiple surgeries without any of the requisite qualifications to do so? To place oneself in a position where one is the only medical recourse for hundreds of men. It seems not only the height of narcissism, but too the most psychopathic of behaviors, the power to kill who knows how many others. And what a dose of Machiavellianism that must entail, to convince a nation's army and manipulate other doctors, a captain, soldiers, the whole lot, that you're the real deal. Damara wasn't humbled by his stint in Korea. Quite the contrary, he was emboldened. When Robert Crichton set out to write his biography, the imposter spent days convincing him to let him deliver his pregnant wife's baby. He could, he assured him, do it better than anyone else. Why rely on a hack when you can get a real medical expert? Crichton, of course, knew rationally that Damara had no training to speak of. But he had saved those soldiers. And he had read all those textbooks, probably more closely than your average doctor. The more Damara cajoled, the more Crichton's resolve to tell him once and for all that his wife was off-limits weakened. It took Crichton's wife, Judy, to put a lid on the plan. He had put the proposal before her in all earnestness. Now that's a true artist. Actually, here's the true artistry. Even after this mishap, as we'll call it, when Judy told Bob that Fred wasn't to set foot in their house again, her resolve too eventually melted away. It was only a few years after the great imposter went away, and after he'd sued Crichton and Random House for allegedly withholding funds, that that same Judy let him babysit their toddler daughter. Now that's a true artist. But the Damaras of this world are only part of the picture. It is possible, it turns out, to possess all the tenets of the dark triad, and then some, and still not turn to con artistry. Psychopaths, narcissists, and Max may be overrepresented in the grift, but they are also overrepresented in a number of other professions that line the legitimate world. As Moorer puts it, if confidence men operate outside the law, it must be remembered that they are not much further outside than many of our pillars of society who go under names less sinister. Leadership in high-profile roles, Wall Street, politics, law. Test most any of them and you'll find a percentage of psychopaths and dark triadists that make Hare's 1% estimate look naively low. When Shelby Hunt and Lawrence Chonko gave the Machiavellianism scale to 1,000 professional marketers, they found that over 10% scored in the highest possible range, and far, far above the population average. In other words, they were among the highest possessors of traits that hinged on manipulation and deception. And yet, they engaged in a legitimate business. None of them were criminals. None of them were even aristocrats of crime. The dark triad pushes people in the direction of manipulation. Christian Geis found that the highest max scores among doctors had consistently chosen to be psychiatrists, a field where manipulation and mental control are central, while in a separate study, Machiavellian students were more likely to specialize in business and law than any other areas. But it does not compel them to push that manipulation beyond a point that's generally socially accepted. And while some would doubtless argue that I've just made my own point, what are politicians, lawyers, businessmen, admin, and marketers but thinly veiled con artists? The truth is that real con artists aren't simply born. They are, as is usually the case, made as well. As the popular saying among scientists goes, genes load the gun, the environment pulls the trigger. The exact same traits could easily be put to use in more or less devious ways. The choice is not predetermined. And the presence of Machiavellianism or psychopathy or narcissism no more marks someone as a grifter than the presence of charisma or nonchalance. James Fallon discovered he was a psychopath by accident. he'd been running two projects simultaneously, a large imaging study of Alzheimer's patients where his own family served as normal control brains, and a small side project on the